Amazon.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Paul Farmer is a stunningly iconoclastic doctor who refuses to accept conventional wisdom on who deserves what globally in healthcare. He's a man on a mission who practices more than he preaches. Pulitzer Prize winner Tracy Kidder's new book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, follows Dr. Farmer from the plateaus of Haiti to the prisons of Siberia, from Cuban hospitals to Peruvian clinics, in a remarkable story of commitment. Tonight, On Point, Paul Farmer and a radical challenge to the way things work. But first, after seven straight months of job losses, the Labor Department announced today U.S. firms have added 57,000 new jobs in September. Wall Street reacted with a big thumbs up. The Dow closed up 84.5 to close at 95.72. Greg Ipp is an economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him how significant the brighter employment numbers are for the overall economic picture.
I think they're very significant, Tom. I mean, this is the first increase in employment that we've seen in 8 months. And almost as important as the fact that employment increased are some of the little details of the report. For example, temporary employment increased by a reasonable amount. And the work week in factories expanded. It went up to about 40.4 hours from 40.2. Now, those sound like small technical issues, but in fact, that's exactly the kind of thing you would expect to see when firms are ramping up production. And what they often do is they hire temps or they expand the hours of the employees they already have before adding to permanent payrolls. I would expect that in the coming months we'll start to see much more sizable increases in employment.
So does this look like the job market turnaround that has lagged the recovery by such a painful margin?
Tom, it's certainly tempting to think that this, in fact, is a turning point, and one would obviously want to take the cautious note that 1 month's employment or 1 month's data of any kind does not a turnaround make. You'd certainly want to see this backed up by another month or two of good news. And let's face it, Tom, the increase in jobs, 57,000, is minuscule in the context of an economy with 130 million people at work right now. And just to put it in perspective, you need at least 125,000 jobs every month just to keep up with the normal growth of the labor force. So anything below that tends to cause the unemployment rate to go up a bit. So I don't want to get too carried away with this. This is a very small increase. It could get revised away in a month or two, but it's definitely a ray of light shining through the gloom.
But overall, unemployment still stands at 6.1%, and we read that the percentage of adults with jobs has fallen to the lowest level in 10 years.
Yes, there's no getting around the fact that for the last few years, the job market has been about the weakest anybody can remember for any period when we were not in a severe recession. And as each year goes by without meaningful job increases, and in fact declines in jobs as we've had, and the population keeps going up, the more and more people of working age there are that are unemployed. It's a very difficult situation to be in. And we see that reflected in the very low confidence people tend to have about the future of the economy, and in particular in the job market. So there's no getting around the fact that we're starting from a very low base, that the job market, notwithstanding there are signs of a turnaround, is in bad shape. But I really hope and expect that a year from now it's going to be looking quite a bit better than this.
Temp agencies showing more activity, more jobs, retailers adding staff, manufacturers still cutting jobs, 29,000 jobs.
Yeah, Tom, this is the 38th straight month that manufacturers have cut jobs. There's been a loss of about almost 3 million jobs from the factory sector in the last 4 or 5 years. It's really extraordinary. We've lost, just to put that in perspective, about one in every six people who was working in a factory job in 1998 no longer has that job. There's multiple factors behind this. It's the recession, it's the loss of jobs to foreign competitors, outsourcing overseas, and part of it is just the continuing trend that we've seen decade after decade of our economy becoming more service-oriented and less sort of blue-collar factory-oriented. All these factors coming together. But even on the factory side, though, there are some good signs. I mean, one thing, for example, is that there were more overtime hours worked at factories in September. Again, that's a sign that production is increasing. Mm-hmm. Now, employers and factories in particular have done a tremendous job of boosting productivity in the last year. What that essentially means is that as sales have increased, they actually haven't had to increase employment to meet those increased sales because each employee is that much more productive. But one gets the sense that they've pushed this about as far as it can go. People are working very hard, and the productivity increases that we've had simply can't be sustained over a long period of time. I think there's strong evidence, Tom, that as employers get the sense that this expansion is for real, they'll lose their reluctance to hire, and that the job situation in the manufacturing area will turn around.
And what about wages? I read that average weekly earnings for rank-and-file workers, and that includes about three-quarters of the workforce, fell for the first time since April, even as the numbers overall on unemployment looked better.
That's right. We've seen some deceleration in wage increases going on for about a year now, and that's really what you would expect in a situation where there's a lot of unemployment and a lot of competition for the jobs that are available. That said, I don't think that trend is going to continue for very long for two reasons. One is that as the job situation turns around, there will be a little bit more competition for the workers that are out there, especially those that have skills. And secondly, the very high productivity trend that seems to be underway for the last 4 or 5 years is consistent with workers earning more. I mean, after all, the more each worker produces, the more they should earn, and the more profits the company that employs them will also earn. So, yes, a little bit of softness right now, but I don't think that that is a long-term trend.
With an average weekly earnings standing now at $520.67, that's the average for about three-quarters of the American workforce. Wall Street loved these numbers today, Greg. Why such a positive response there?
Well, Tom, it's a situation that we've been down so long, it looks like up to us. I mean, frankly, the big mystery, of course, is why hasn't employment turned around sooner than this? But going into Friday's jobs report, people had heard just so much gloominess about the job situation. Everybody from President Bush on down was obsessing over how do we get more jobs. And I think people were really braced for a much worse picture than they actually got. And so the what you basically saw on Wall Street today was a relief rally.
56% of people disapproving of President Bush's handling of the economy now. That's one of his worst poll findings on that front. But does it look, Greg, that he may actually go into the heart of the campaign season with an economy building under him nicely?
I think the odds are that the economy gets better from here as opposed to getting worse, and that, yes, all else equal, that should be good for the president. Of course, there's a lot of other factors that will be coming into play between now and then. One of them, will be the progress of the war in Iraq. Another factor will be how effective the Democrats are at attacking his record on the fiscal situation, because, of course, in the name of creating more jobs, he's passed tax cuts and gone easy with spending increases, which have given us very, very large deficits. And, of course, the expansion and the economic recovery is not yet baked in the cake. Any number of things could come along to derail us right now. The stock market could take another turn for the worse. Housing prices could turn down. There could be a major terrorist attack, you know, and so on and so on and so on. I don't want to get you all depressed for the weekend now going over the litany of things that could go wrong.
We're going to go out on the good numbers and keep our fingers crossed for now.
Right.
But we take your point. Plenty of potholes out there, but some good numbers today. Greg Ipp, thanks for joining us.
All right, Tom.
Greg Ipp is economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. He's a driven, world-class doctor who brings modern medicine to those who have been all but abandoned by modernity. His patients struggle not only with HIV and tuberculosis, but with three-hour walks to the clinic, no running water, no employment, no money. He sought out corners of the world that most people, most likely, including you, wholly ignore, and invested his life there. Dr. Paul Farmer, with his radical quest to cure the world, is the subject of Tracy Kidder's compelling new book, Mountains Beyond Mountains. Can you imagine devoting your life to directly aiding the poorest of the world's poor? And when you really think about it, how do you justify to yourself not doing more? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight, author and essayist Tracy Kidder, Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award winner for his 1981 book, The Soul of a New Machine. His latest book is Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, A Man Who Would Cure the World. Good evening and welcome, Tracy Kidder.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Also joining us in the studio is Paul Farmer, co-founder of Partners in Health, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and author of Pathologies of Power, Health, Human Rights, and the New War on the Poor. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Paul Farmer.
Thank you.
Tracy Kidder, history has shown us that we're fascinated with what you're fascinated with. If not before, then after we get done reading you about it. So what got you into this man and his cause?
Well, we met because of a beheading in Haiti in the mid-90s when I was doing a story about American soldiers, and Paul showed up to talk about the murder case with the American commander. And I think that I then ran into him on the plane back to Miami and then had dinner with him subsequently. That was in 94. And I didn't really pursue him. I mean, I ordinarily would have pursued someone who had such an extraordinary and interesting story, I think.
But you weren't there to write about health care. This was when Bill Clinton was involved with Haiti, I guess, and U.S. troops were around.
Right, but I was doing one story, and I think I'd been shown my way to a more interesting one. Mm-hmm. But I think that, frankly, I think now that, that I was afraid Paul here threatened my peace of mind. I was pretty shocked by Haiti when I saw it in the mid-90s, and I was trying to find a way to accommodate it with my comfortable, you know, American life, the fact of Haiti, and reconcile it somehow. And I kind of sensed that if I started hanging out with him, or if he let me hang out with him, comfortable sense, that whole thing would be shaken, my whole notion of...
And indeed, as I read the book, Tracy Kidder, Mountains Beyond Mountains, if he was a threat to your peace of mind, then he remained a threat to your peace of mind. In fact, kind of grew as a threat to your peace of mind as you followed him around and wrote this book. Why? What's the threat here?
Well, I just think that most Americans like to think that we deserve, and you know, that we've earned and deserve our privileges. And, you know, if you get to see the world through the lens of medicine, as Paul showed it to me, you realize, of course, that that's just sheer vanity. And also, I think you realize just what terrible shape the world is in, particularly if you see it through the lens of medicine. But I didn't become increasingly uncomfortable. I had my uncomfortable moments. And by the end, it was I've never been on a more exhilarating journey, actually. It was like an adventure for me.
Yeah.
A moral adventure, if that's not too little a word.
No, a moral adventure. And I guess that adventure always comes with a kind of threat attached to it. That's what makes it adventure, isn't it? But we don't think of a doctor and a clinic as being challenging in quite the way that you convey in this book. Paul Farmer, can you tell us how you first got involved with Haiti? And this will be in a very tiny nutshell, and what you've built there.
Well, I work with many people, so I can't use first person singular.
Make it plural.
I became interested in Haiti back in really many, many years ago, before I ever went to Haiti, meeting Haitians who were migrant farm workers in this country, in the United States. And in the same way that Tracy describes having his world, in some ways, his understanding of life and our lives, challenged by something that happened to me with meeting Haitians who were working in very difficult circumstances as migrant farm workers. And I asked them, you know, why would you leave your home country to work in conditions like this in the United States? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the answer I got back then was, well, have you ever been to Haiti? And I hadn't. And so I went to Haiti in 1983 after meeting migrant farm workers. And
how old were you then?
I was 23.
Okay.
And, you know, I have never really been able to reconcile my peace of mind with Haiti either. So I don't see why Tracy shouldn't be suffer as I did.
And well, should I guess that we'll come to the clinic. I want to hear about it. But that brings up the bigger question. We're going to hear all about your work tonight. But as we sit here, should anybody in the listening audience be feeling comfortable? Is that your fundamental challenge, Paul Farmer, that Tracy Kidder is kind of trumpeting to the world here? Get uncomfortable?
He sure is trumpeting it, I'll tell you. I would rather that not be the primary message. But, you know, in reading the book myself, as especially the second time around, more as a reader than as a subject, you know, there are really terrible conditions, and looking at these conditions through the lens of medicine, as you said, reminds us that there's really so much to do that isn't being done, so much that could be done to remediate all sorts of unnecessary suffering. And so I think for those who enjoy a modicum of comfort and freedom from want, not being hungry, not being wet when it rains, not being alone when they're sick, I think for all of us who live like that, there's reason to be concerned about those who don't have access to these basic, I would call them human rights. And so although telling people to wake up and be uncomfortable is not going to win anyone any popularity contests, I think that there's reason to do that. I'm not sure I'm cut out for that, personally, but I think people should be Do they have cause to worry about?
Paul Farmer, it is now thrust upon you by the very writer on your left. We're talking tonight with author Tracy Kidder about a phenomenal doctor who is driven to treat the world's poor and maybe to turn your world upside down in the process. The new book is Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, a man who would cure the world. You can join the conversation. Are you up to the challenge that Paul Farmer represents, and be honest, what's the furthest you stretch yourself in support of your own ideals? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with author Tracy Kidder about a phenomenal doctor who is driven to treat the world's poor and maybe turn your world upside down in the process. Tracy Kidder's new book is Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, a man who would cure the world. They both joined me in the studio tonight. You can join us as well. What does the rich world owe the poor? Not hypothetically, but really. And do we live day to day in complete denial of what life is like in much of the world? How do you deal with that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tracy Kidder, you present in your book a complex man in a very complex setting in Haiti and elsewhere around the world. Give us a sense, first, of the complexity of Haiti, the circumstances that people face there that Paul Farmer is addressing.
Well, they're appalling circumstances. Malnutrition, disease, you name it. Deforestation and so on. One of the things, though, I mean, here, just to give you a sense of the kind of experience I had, you come through this blasted landscape, through the Central Plateau, and then you finally come to the center of this healthcare system that Paul and Partners in Health have created. And I tell you, it is one of the most uplifting feelings I ever had in my life. I mean, I had grown accustomed before I did this to waking up in the morning, reading the newspapers, seeing stories about AIDS and TB throughout the world, and thinking, this is hopeless, this is too big, it's too complicated. And suddenly to be presented with, even if on a relatively small scale, this astonishingly sort of upbeat thing. I mean, this
describe the scene. Put us there. What's it look like? What's going on there?
You drive for 3 hours to go about 35 miles on the
road. Port-au-Prince.
From Port-au-Prince, yeah, on a road that's really a dry riverbed, basically. You see the trees get thinner. There's no electricity. You see people begging. You see all kinds of, you see starved-looking animals and so on and so forth. And suddenly you come to this oasis, really. It's on a mountainside. It looks like a fortress. It's covered with tropical greenery. And then you get inside to the courtyard and you have the relief of smooth pavement. But the other thing, the more important thing is that...
And this is the Partners in Health clinic that
this
you're
This is Partners in Health's, medical complex. It's a hospital. Right. It's got an optometry clinic. They've done open heart surgery there. I can't tell you. I mean, the point is all the care there is first rate and all of it is free. And it's it just takes all of those terrible things like AIDS. I mean, if you can treat AIDS in that place, you can treat it anywhere. And they're treating AIDS there. You feel like, God, there is hope. You know, it's not so much that you feel like, oh, I feel so guilty because other people in the world are hurting.
So here's something blooming here.
Yeah, I mean, it's much better than just sort of feeling guilty and wallowing in that to say, my God, something can be done. And it took extraordinary measures to do it, but sometimes it takes an extraordinary person or group of people and extraordinary measures to show us what's possible.
We're going to look at that personality. But Paul Farmer, as Tracy Kidder writes it, your complex, abundant medical complex there in Haiti, stands as a kind of rebuke to conventional assumptions about what healthcare medicine should be in the third world, about the resources that are worth putting into it. What is that rebuke? I'm not sure we're all clued into that debate.
Well, I mean, just look at the mortality. Look at the deaths that happen every year. I mean, this year there are going to be 6 million people who will die of AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, three diseases that can be treated. Two of them can be cured. Third one controlled with medicines that we've developed And so, yes, I suppose it is a rebuke because we're using those medicines to make sure that deaths like that don't occur. Same for women's health. You know, a group recently went down to visit our women's health clinic, and they interviewed the head of women's health there, an obstetrician gynecologist, a Haitian colleague of mine. And they said, what is the maternal mortality rate here, which means how many women die in childbirth? And he said, none, zero. We haven't had any women die here.
This compared to
over 1,000 per 100,000 live births, which is the highest in the hemisphere. That's Haiti's rate.
In Haiti generally. But you've got a more fundamental kind of critique going on here. Tracy Kidder quotes a German scholar, perhaps a kind of mentor of yours, Rudolf Virchow, who said, medicine is a social science and politics is nothing but medicine on a large scale. I mean, fundamentally, what's he saying? What are you saying there? That we should turn our pockets inside out and spend whatever it takes to make everybody in Haiti and elsewhere healthy?
Why not? I mean, I think that would be a great development, personally. I think that there are abundant resources in the world today to take on these remediable problems. I mean, there are solutions out there. If they're available to some, then they ought to be available to others on the basis of need. Right now, I guess the rebuke that you're referring to is we tend to sell these services to those who can pay for them. And now in Haiti, that happens to be a very tiny minority of people, and certainly the sick are by and large those who can't pay for those services.
We sell them. What about the World Health Organization and UNESCO? And we have a sense that there's a great international skein of institutions out there taking care of these problems.
Well, they're not. I mean, they should and maybe they will, but they're not so far, or there would not be all these unnecessary deaths. That is the rebuke. The numbers are the rebuke.
Tracy Kidder, here's the radical challenge I'm reading in this book. Paul Farmer says, don't be stingy. Don't just eke it out the end of the aid hose. Turn it on full blast. Put poor resources in there. This is kind of at odds with all the thinking says, look, we have limited resources. Let's be serious. We can only do so much for these people. One day their economies will grow and they'll all be better off. Paul Farmer's saying something radically different here.
Yeah, I mean, all of that stuff that you just cited is nonsense. Of course, their economies won't grow if they're all dying of AIDS. But you know, it's not a question of emptying our pockets. That's the thing that's astonishing to me. I mean, at Zami La Santé, you cure...
The clinic in Kanj.
I'm sorry, Kanj in Haiti, where...
The village of Kanj, they've
Partners in Health's medical mm-hmm. complex there, mm-hmm. their medical system, really, which is now being expanded to cover an eighth of Haiti. They cure an uncomplicated case with TB with 100% efficacy, if that's the right word, for less than $200. They treat a person with AIDS with astonishing effectiveness for about $700 a year.
So extrapolate from that. What does that mean? Does that mean that legions of Dr. Farmers could march into Haiti and Congo and Peru and the rest of it and take care of it and do it? Do we really have the resources to
Absolutely,
do that?
Is that what we could saying? Do that. We could probably, I don't know the exact figures. My guess is that if we weren't in Iraq, we could use that money to, we'd go a long way towards beginning to do that. But, you know, it's not simple. I don't mean to say that it's easy. But I do know that part of Haiti is probably as hard a place to work in as any in the world. And if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere.
Paul Farmer, what does it mean then in that case that the world doesn't do that? How do you interpret that?
Well, I mean, it depends on how charitable one feels in the exercise of interpreting that.
The range.
Well, the range would be people just don't know. And therefore, the reason they're not generous and the reason they're not engaged in the struggle for health as a human right is because they just don't know. Now, I prefer to think that that's the case because the alternatives are not attractive. People know and they don't care. And I really don't believe that to be the case. I think people
Come on,
are
television's
unaware.
Out there, the camera's all over
well,
the place.
No,
We've
I
all
would,
seen
I,
the, you know, I, the public television
no,
documentaries,
no
the please help the children ads. I mean,
well,
aren't they everywhere? The garbage pickers in Manila, the works. It's been out there for years, hasn't it?
Well, no offense to you, Tom, but the media may not be our best ally in this struggle for health and human rights. I think that there are some media that are giving a message that's really not it's not a clear analysis of what's going on. If you want to look at garbage pickers in Manila and not understand, how social inequality is created over time and maintained, well, then you have television to do that for you. But I think that, there are people out there who want to know more about, what we can do with very, as Tracy said, with limited resources, we can do enormous. We can save a lot of lives, and we can let people make their own choices about how everything from how big they'd like their family to be to what they want their children to do. But if we leave things to progress as they are now, we're really heading towards a world where there are the haves and the have-nots, and the medical haves and the medical have-nots. And I think that that's going to be a disastrous way to proceed if we have developed.
Aren't we already there? Aren't we deeply there already?
We're well on our way.
On our way. I mean, look around the world. Isn't the have and have-not line very, very, very clear?
It's very clear. But take the angle that Tracy mentioned, which is the medical angle. Some of these tools, for example, the treatment for HIV or for AIDS, mm-hmm. HIV disease, these tools have been developed fairly recently. Even antibiotics in general, they're 60 years old, the oldest ones. And again, we've been well on our way to this sort of haves and have-nots that started, you know, hundreds of years ago. But what we're really seeing now, I think, is a worsening, because with the development of every new medical technology, the absence of an equity plan, a way of using these tools fairly based on need, means that inequality gets deeper, more profound,
because
worse.
The rich get the benefit of all the new developments and the poor just don't.
That's
get
right.
It.
And then I think that is new. You know, you 50 years ago, you didn't have all of these
just
tools.
Quinine all around
and a couple of other things. Mm-hmm. But now we can manage almost any serious disease pathology. And again, I'm speaking as a physician, but I think this stands for other technologies as well, engineering feats, educational services, etc. So I do think that, yes, we're already well on our way to a world of haves and have-nots, but it can get worse.
But it can also get better. And you're saying, hey, we can change this. We can cure this from medicine and right on through. We're talking tonight with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tracy Kidder and Paul Farmer, the subject of his new book. He calls Dr. Paul Farmer a man who would cure the world. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Kevin's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. Great fan of the show. I enjoy it a lot.
Great.
Question for your guest is, I admire what you're doing, and you know, I think there ought to be a lot more citizens like yourself around. Question is, do you ever feel the desire or impulse to do similar work in this country? I mean, there are many poverty-stricken neighborhoods and communities across the country, and you know, HIV/AIDS rates, particularly high among African-American Latino communities.
Kevin, we've got it. And let me take it right there, because as a famous radio guy says, you know, and now the rest of the story. There is more to this story that's not just in Haiti and overseas, but it's a great question. Tracy Kidder, fill us in on the stateside angle to Paul Farmer's work.
It's pretty interesting. It has a wonderful wrinkle to it. The techniques that Partners in Health basically created in Haiti to deal with HIV and tuberculosis, they have now imported back to the United States to an AIDS program that they have right here in, I believe it's in Roxbury, which is a wonderful technology transfer from Haiti to Boston in medicine. I mean, probably unheard of.
In Roxbury, a poor segment of Boston.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For patients who were not responding well to AIDS treatment, they've taken this community-based medicine approach that they use in Haiti to great effect, and they're using it to great effect here in the United States. And I have no doubt that we could begin to solve some of our own terrible medical problems here, public health problems, really, if we looked at pretty closely at some of these techniques.
Well, and I should say, you also described Paul Farmer doing his rounds in a major hospital in Boston. Yes. with a whole range of kinds of patients there. And if I recall one story, a kind of a Christmas Day or Christmas Eve segment of rounds where his care included a six-pack of beer. Well, the guy needed it. And for that six-pack of beer, he earned the accolade Saint. It's not the first time that has been applied to Paul Farmer, and you come close to it in your book. Are you... I mean, you know what you do, Tracy. You kind of lift things up out of the ordinary. You put a certain spotlight on them, a certain luster around them. Are you telling us that we've got a new Albert Schweitzer sitting with us tonight, a new Mother Teresa? Is that the point?
Well, let's leave those two historical examples aside.
In popular culture, these are kind of the peaks service and commitment in third world and medicine.
I don't think he's a saint. He's much too much fun to be around to be a saint. And besides, saint is the kind of term we apply to people in order, I think, to dismiss them. That is to say, let's look at this. Look at this person doing this stuff. No one else can do it. And I mean, I do grant you that probably most people won't do what Paul has done. He doesn't sleep very much, and he hasn't kept much of anything for himself. But I think, as I said this earlier, sometimes it takes an extraordinary person to show us what's possible. And I have no doubt that he is an extraordinary person, but I resist the notion of his being a saint.
Though, as I read the book, it did occur to you. Tim's calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hello. Well, I guess I just wanted to comment on something that was said earlier. You'd asked, you know, what have you done yourselves to kind of espouse your beliefs? And, you know, I guess...
that's really the question that Paul Farmer raises here by his example. What's your response, Tim?
Well, I came to Eau Claire a few years ago as a teacher, and we started a summer service program where my kids could, you know, leave Eau Claire and go around the country to areas like Appalachia, for example, and work with communities, building houses, you know, doing things like that. The important thing about any of that is the idea that you can kind of leave, what, like you said before, your comfort zone and be exposed to something different. And the cool thing that's happened, I think, with our program here in Eau Claire is that, you know, these kids come back from these experiences where, you know, they can leave their sheltered world, you know, here behind in an upper middle class area, and you know, they do something good elsewhere, and they bring a spirit back with them that, you know, makes them want to help out in ways around town here that, you know, maybe they wouldn't have otherwise.
Tim, we've got it, and it's a great example. I want to put it to Paul Farmer and get his response. Thanks very much for your call, Tim. Paul Farmer, you know this kind of trip. Kids go on it, people go on it, they see what they see, and they go home. You went on a trip of a kind when you were 23 and ended up devoting your life to it. What's your sense of what a person's responsibility is once they've gone out and seen what they see, whether it's in Appalachia or in Haiti or, you know, the Congo, you name it? What's then the responsibility? You talked about wondering if people don't really know, but once people have seen, what's your honest assessment of what an affluent person in the modern world's responsibility is once having witnessed?
Well, my honest assessment. I really think that the proper response to seeing suffering is action. Is, you know, and because we are able to act. You know, we have the latitude, you know, the example from Eau Claire, you know, about upper middle class kids. Mm-hmm. That the entire point of the program, I was going to say exercise, but obviously it's not meant as an exercise, is to have these people understand their own privilege, and then keep engaged. And you know, I teach at Harvard Medical School, and I work with many people at Partners in Health. Many of them are former students of mine, or were students, and they are people who understand, I think, their own privilege, and have remained engaged, and that's in a way how we built up part of this this organization, including, to get back to Kevin's point, the part of it that is serving people right here close to our medical mecca, and I think that's important.
I was fascinated by the way Tracy Kidder conveys, and you know well, that Haitians are not unaware of these inequities at all. They have this wonderful proverb, "God gives but doesn't share," meaning, Paul Farmer?
Well, you know, it's something that confused me the first time I heard it, because it sounds
like a Zen cone.
Yeah, like a Zen cone. But what it really means is that, you know, humans have what it takes to do well on the face of the planet.
The abundance is there.
The abundance is there. But the problem is not that God doesn't give humans what they need to flourish, but rather that humans don't share it. That they're not sharing properly. And that's how the Haitians interpret it. I think they're right.
We're talking tonight with author Tracy Kidder about a phenomenal doctor who is driven to treat the world's poor. Lots of challenge in this conversation. Do we live day to day in denial of what life is in much of the world? And what's the role of a driven soul like Paul Farmer to inspire, to shame, to turn the status quo upside down? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tracy Kidder about a phenomenal doctor who is driven to treat the world's poor. Tracy Kidder's new book is Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, A Man Who Would Cure the World. They are both with me in the studio tonight. You can join us as well. Can you imagine striding straight into the third world to help it with your own hands? Have you done it? And can the rich world find the humility, the humanity, to learn from Haiti to share more than scraps? And should it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve's calling from Exeter, New Hampshire. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for Dr. Farmer about Doctors Without Borders.
Now, yes.
I used to donate to them until they started their Access to Essential Medicines campaign, which essentially says that drug companies' prices for essential medicines like HIV drugs mm-hmm. should be forced down by various pressures and provided to poorer countries, which is an indirect way of saying the drug company employees and investors ought to be the ones that pay the charity for that, even though Doctors Without Borders wouldn't say that directly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, that distressed me a lot. I stopped giving to them. I think, of course, that the charity to provide essential medicines is something that's an obligation of all of us, not just drug company employees. And it's not only, I mean, of course, Doctors Without Borders has that policy for drug companies after, not before, they develop a successful AIDS drug.
Steve, let me ask you a question. It sounds like you were contributing before. But what if those prices are keeping, let's say, millions of people from getting the drugs, then what's the answer?
Well, the answer is for all of us to provide the necessary charity, not just the drug companies. In fact, it's not only it's a form of dishonesty to change the rules after the drug companies develop drugs, but it's also bad health policy because it seems to me we ought to want to pump profits into drug companies and take the profits out of, say, General Motors for their great profits on SUVs or whatever else.
So you're saying some market forces here and a whole lot of charity, but don't crowbar the prices down. You raise a really great question. That's a very hot one politically in the UN and around the world. Thanks for calling, Steve, with it. Paul Farmer, what's your view on this? Big drug companies, big need for the products they produce, big profits there, and Doctors Without Borders saying, we want these driven down.
Well, you know, I certainly appreciate, if I can use your first name, Steve's, point that we have to be intellectually and morally honest about this, you know, this taking on these big problems. I don't disagree with that part. I really don't. I think, though, if we go through that exercise of looking hard, we find out some curious things. And I must say also, Steve, that I wasn't very interested in this topic before it was pushed on me as a doctor.
Why not? You're happy to pay the price for the medicine?
No, not that at all. It's just that, you know, you can only do so many things in terms of, you know, knowing an area. And my area was, in terms of medicine, was infectious disease. But there were these barriers between me and providing proper care for patients who couldn't pay. And so I did spend some time trying to look at it, and I did discover that, first of all, many of these drugs were not developed by the pharmaceutical companies. They were developed in, you know, in government-sponsored labs in universities, for example. Not all of them, but some of them. I found out that the pharmaceutical industry posts the highest profits of all the major industries, more than in commercial banking, for example. I didn't know that until I looked into it. Mm-hmm. I also discovered that they spend some of these companies spend more on advertising than they do on research and development. So although I really couldn't agree more that we need to be intellectually and morally honest about this, I would say that we do need another strategy for making drugs, especially for epidemic disease, available to those who need them, not simply those who can pay for them. And, you know, what those strategies should be, I think we should work out. For example, should we declare certain diseases global health emergencies? 2 weeks ago, the new director general of the World Health Organization said that AIDS is a global health emergency. That's 20 years, you know, after we concluded it was an emergency.
And with that declaration, then reach into the pharmaceutical companies, the storehouses, and distribute the drugs for free?
Well,
is that what you're saying?
Well, first of all, yes, the drugs should be distributed free. I'm not embarrassed to say that, to the patients who need them. The financing of this kind of program, this campaign, there are many, and I think Steve points this out, there are many different, everybody should be involved, international financial institutions, people who can afford to help.
But bottom line, also, would you put a cap on the prices that the drug companies can charge?
I would, if necessary, and I'm not a health economist.
Do you see it as a long-term danger if that's done? Steve is suggesting if you do that, you're not going to have drugs in the next generation.
Yes, that's something we hear an awful lot, and I hear that from friends of mine in the industry. At the same time, they're also, one has to ask, is there such a thing as a public health emergency? And if there is such a thing as a public health emergency, AIDS is one of them. And the mechanisms that we have in place so far don't work because otherwise you wouldn't have, 42 million people living with this disease, and, less than 1% of Africans who need these medications have access to them, far less than 1%. So I would ask you to reconsider supporting the Campaign for Essential Medicine. I mean, this is just a doctor's plea. I think that, you know, you might want to reconsider it. And I myself believe that we do need new strategies around a wide variety of medications that I think we should reconsider as essential.
Steve, thanks for your call. Tracy Kidder, you've met, I'm sure, many doctors in the process of doing this book on Paul Farmer. There are many doctors working out there in the world, and not all in fancy, you know, clinics in Beverly Hills. What sets this man apart? Why have you spent this much time with this doctor?
Well, I think he's obviously there are a lot of doctors who have given good portions of their lives to do this kind of work. But I don't know of any personally who's done it more effectively. He's also very interesting. He has a wonderful, colorful life story. I'm a storyteller first of all. And I think that precedes any altruistic impulses I have. I thought I had a really good story here.
Tell us a little bit of that background story, because it is terrific. There's a lot of biography woven through here. And this whole conversation makes us wonder, out of the millions of people who do nothing, who is it that has the character to hope and to act? You've got a very unique background with Paul Farmer. Give us just a brief sense of it.
He grew up on a bus with his five siblings and his mom and dad, and then his dad moved them on to a kind of leaky old 50-foot-long half-homemade houseboat moored on a bayou in Florida. And
When he lives in Haiti now, in a small house on
upgrade.
It's an upgrade from the sinking boat.
I once said to his mother, "No couch potatoes in your family," and she said, "No couch." That's the kind of story that may explain everything or nothing. You know, he went on to Duke on full scholarship and on to, it wasn't a cushy childhood. It wasn't a terribly deprived one, I don't think, but it was interesting. And I think it was unusual. And I think also it perhaps saved him from being too deeply inculcated in convention and later on in conventional wisdom. And if I could go on with that, I mean,
yeah.
The thing, and it's not just Paul, of course, he's got all these people around him, and he's always had this fascinating cast of characters around him from really the beginning of this work, among them Tom White, you know, once the owner of the largest construction company in Boston.
Big Boston developer who has supported with, what, millions of dollars?
Millions and millions and millions of dollars, who is in his 80s now and who told me not so very long ago that he wanted to leave this life without a nickel and who is doing a very good job of that.
And Paul's helping.
And Paul's helped him a great deal. And
I'm doing my best to help him
and,
out.
And Jim Young Kim, another Harvard doc, a Korean-American who has been right there with all of these projects, and also I guess the other fourth in the sort of original core is Ophelia Dahl, the daughter of the writer Roald Dahl and the actress Patricia Neal, who
mm-hmm.
I think of as the glue of Partners in Health. She's the sort of peacekeeper. But you know what? What I do think part of that background of Paul's, which I've just sketched to you, brings to the table is. I think of this thing that happened in Peru where they came across an epidemic of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, a very scary disease. And they were basically told by the World Health Authorities, you can't treat it in a place like this. Never mind that New York City, that the United States has spent about $1 billion treating it in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was very interesting. I mean, here you say it's not cost-effective. That sounds very interesting. I mean, that souns authoritative. That sounds like, okay, well, we better
can't
not
be done.
Do it.
It'd be foolish.
Better not do it. Turned out that no one had ever tried to treat it effectively. And when Paul and Jim and the rest of Partners in Health applied good principles of infectious disease and public health to this problem, they managed to cure about 85%, which is better than we do in Denver, by the way. So much for the effective side of the cost-effectiveness analysis. Then you get turned to the cost side. Well, it was tremendously costly. They spent most of their endowment that they'd been hoarding, Partners in Health did, to take on a very small part of this epidemic. But why was it costly? It was costly because the drugs cost so damn much money. And why did all these drugs were off patent, all but one class of them were off patent. No one who had been making this pronouncement that it was not cost effective had ever looked into the reason why the drugs were so costly. And Jim Kim and with some help from Doctors Without Borders and with help from some people in the World Health Organization, opposition from others, and with a lot of help from a generic drug company in the Netherlands, have now driven the price of those drugs down by 95%.
Paul Farmer, what's the bottom line here? I want to understand your vision. If we should unlock all the cupboards of wealth and send out legions of Dr. Paul Farmers into the world, are you saying that your experience in an eighth of Haiti can be multiplied across all the underdeveloped world and, I don't know, in 50 or 100 years, it could be one big, healthy, global family? I mean, it sounds like a silly question, but I think a lot of people have sort of written that off as a possibility. Are you saying it is possible, or we should just do the best we can, push back the darkness as far as it can be pushed?
Well, you know, a couple things come to mind before I venture an authoritative answer to that question.
Yes, please.
First of all, you know, the work that we do in Haiti is done with a Haitian staff. We have, you know, most of these, my coworkers in Haiti are they're living in the villages where they were raised, and they're community health workers. Same in Roxbury, the project that that Tracy mentioned here. These are people who live in Roxbury and Dorchester. And
granted, it won't all be white missionaries from afar.
In fact, that's what I'm telling you. It's not. And so you're talking about a legion of
still, it will take human interaction as well as capital.
Absolutely.
But the bottom line question, our time is short, is can it be done?
It can be done. I have no question. I have no doubt, rather, that it can be done. I am absolutely convinced that if a small group of people like Partners in Health, with help from, granted, you know, people at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School and people like Tom White, if a small group like that can do it in central Haiti with our Haitian partners, then we can do it anywhere.
Jack's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi. I've got a question for Dr. Farmer. I'm a first-year medical student here in Boston, and I'm really interested in doing some work abroad, I guess sort of in the way that you've done, although probably on a much smaller scale in the future. And I'm wondering about any sort of tips that you might have and how you first got involved doing that kind of work.
It's a great question. Thanks for calling, Jack. Paul Farmer.
Never let a patient know you're in a hurry. And
Tracy Kidder's
advice. We have problems, too.
Well, that, you know, all joking aside, that's an important one. And the other is take your hepatitis A vaccine and your chloroquine. No, good tips. I think that, find partners. You know, you're in medical school in Boston. That's great. You know, an American medical education is a great medical education, really almost everywhere in this country. And so find reliable partners and stay engaged over time throughout your medical school training, throughout your residency training. And, when you're done and you find yourself already deeply rooted in a group, in a community perhaps, in another place where there are enormous shortages of exactly what you have to offer, I think you'll be glad that you did it all the way through medical school.
Tracy Kidder, you've walked out in the hills of Haiti and sweated, tagging along, trying to keep up with Paul Farmer as he's walked way, way out to deliver the goods, check up on patients and all the rest. You've seen the poverty there. You've seen what he's doing. I'm hearing you on balance say you come away from this uplifted. You come lifted up, optimistic.
Yeah, I do, actually. I mean, the alternative, of course, is to declare despair on behalf of all of these other people who are, a lot less, a lot worse shape than I am. But that's, this would not be interesting to me. I mean, Partners in Health would be a nice little organization, and Paul would be a fascinating guy with a tremendously agile mind and so on. But for these actual, real examples. I mean, it's as though they said to the world, you say this is too complicated, too expensive, impossible to do. And we say, no, it's not. And here's the proof. And here the proof is in Partners in Health in Haiti, in this place called Zami La Santé. It's in Peru. It's in Russia now, and it's in Boston. I feel optimistic. I don't like the alternative either.
None of us do. Tracy Kidder, keep writing, and thanks for the new book.
Thank you.
Tracy Kidder's book is Mountains Beyond Mountains, the Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, a man who would cure the world. Paul Farmer, cure the world.
I'm at it.
Thanks for being with us. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.